The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the producers and or the persons appearing on the program and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of CIUT-FM.
Proudly student and listener-supported community radio. CIUT 89.5 FM, celebrating 35 years as the sound of your city.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Lo and behold, as we keep saying, we're in the studio, and I should read probably the date of a newspaper, the way they do with, you know, people taken hostage, so it's, everybody knows it's real. We're joined by Phil Conlon, Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., veteran trade unionist, got all the necessary makeup in his history to about today's topics. We're going to talk about important books that have to do with war. There's a new one out, Phil, I Ain't a Marching Anymore. It's a title. And it was speaking to those of your generation who weren't marching anymore. And it says there's people arguing that, making the argument, very good one, that there should be some monuments to the people who resist wars like the Vietnam War, which was a horror from any perspective, terrible. Anyway, I recognize you without your mask, although I had to check. But how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. And yes, we ain't marching anymore. I like to tell people that I had a wonderful mother who had three sons and who said, none of my sons will go into the military by one way or another. And she accomplished that. None of her sons did.
I like that. That was a mother. Of course, she was part of a lifelong part of a peace movement, right?
That's right. She was a Catholic worker.
So in other words, she was living by her conscience and didn't change her views because there was a headline that said something that there's a good reason to go or some such thing. I think we should say, I like what Nixon, that was the president of the United States at one time, said there was a silent majority. When you come close to major conflicts, there is a silent majority goes about making, they have their own foreign policy. And they say, not me, you know, maybe like the guy down the street, but, and they have a lot of good reasons, actually. It's a pity that they don't discuss it more openly, but in wartime, and it is sometimes hazardous to have an opinion. So people vote with what they used to call their feet. And important matter.
Right.
Go ahead.
Phil, last week's program, you raised the name of Eugene Debs. And that's the kind of person that people should know about Eugene Debs. He went to jail for having an opinion. He did a lot of time in jail, too. He didn't go for 30 days. He was there for several years. Right.
Yes.
And his opinion was that workers had no, as Bill Clinton used to say, I have no dog in this, whatever it was.
Turned out he did. You're talking about Clinton now.
Yeah, right.
He had dogs in every fight. Yeah,
right, but Deb said the working class had no interest in the outcome of World War One. He said that this is these people are using working class people all over Europe to kill each other over things that don't concern the working class and can't help the working class. And boy, I'd like to have some labor leaders who would talk like that in North America.
Well, we do. Last week's show, Kim Sipes. And I have to say, and I would say, first of all, CLC, if you're listening, please take note. There was a serious effort by members of the AFL-CIO, went to the convention with the principles mentioned by Kim Sipes, whose article on this subject, by the way, can be found in Covert Action magazine. The title of the article, part of the title, the best part, is Challenge AFL-CIO Foreign Policy. And arguing for an independent position by labor. In other words, labor should tell its members, speak for its members, what interest do we have in whatever the big, you know, foreign policy questions of the day, let us review them from the best interests of labor, organized labor, with the first principle being we benefit from peace, we usually do not benefit from war, usually, and we don't benefit. And so I was, now we're going to be talking about this in the latter portion of the show. There's some other matters we're going to take up first, but I will just say that in the latter portion we're going to talk about a second excellent article by Richard Moser. The site is Be Freedom, which is kind of a Zen concept. BeFreedom.co. Can't be .co, can it? Yeah, maybe it can. Anyhow, that title would just about do it. I mean, Richard Moser, and we will cover his views in this, as I say, second half of the show, but he's arguing the duties of trade unions to challenge on foreign policy. So there's something going on. You remember that line of Dylan's? Something's happening and you don't understand, do you, Mr. Jones? And anyhow, but let us speak of something. Apropos of war, I have been reading a book here that I really urge everybody to see, to have a look at. It's Robert Graves. You remember Robert Graves, Phil?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't. Okay. So tell me about Robert Graves. Well,
he wrote a novel called I, Claudius, that it became a celebrated TV series. They turned it into, in the late 70s and the 80s, I believe. It's to this day talked about as one of the great programs, and it's all based on the story of the emperor, Claudius. But Robert Graves was probably, and I should not say was, is one of the great poets of the 20th century. He's also a great essayist and historian. But he had very special credentials, in my view, and I would think it would interest you. He served in World War I. By the way, he joined in that casual way where you just don't think twice. You just, somebody says, oh, terrible things are happening in Belgium. The Germans have entered Belgium, and therefore he went down and joined. And because he's a very highly educated man, he was I would call him upper class. His father was also a poet, but a high-powered British education bureaucrat. And so Graves went to war, and he really served his time. He was wounded terribly about midway through the war. I think it was 1916. He was hit with a bomb went off behind him, and a shell, actually. There wasn't a lot of plane activity, but a shell went off. Very nearly died. As a matter of fact, his mother received from his commanding officer a very touching letter saying what a wonderful young man he had been, and he regretted to inform her that poor Robert, a hero, had died at his post, of course, very bravely. He had been at his post very bravely, but he had just been terribly wounded. And this is the things that I think any young person, but all families, should read these books, people who actually went in, served, and had these experiences. Since the shell, the shrapnel went through his lung, and one, he had several pieces. He said he kept one in his eyebrow just as a have, he said. So he didn't want them to dig it out because he said he thought it kind of helped his looks a little bit. Anyway, they looked at him and thought, well, he's a goner. So they put him on a stretcher, and they put him in a corner where they were putting the goners. And his commanding officer had inquired about him, and they said, no, he's not going to make it. So then he sat down, sadly, and wrote the mother. And by the way, it wasn't just him. She also got her official notice that your son has died. And then, of course, he had, when he began to turn and come back, regained his strength, he wrote her a letter, and his letter was wrongly dated, And so she got a letter from him saying, I was hit, but I'm okay. That's what he said. I'm sorry, man. I'm okay. And she's looking at the official notice. Since the dates of the letters were scrambled, she decided that he had thought he was going to live and had died. To just add further to this story, we're speaking of Robert Graves, by the way, and the book is Goodbye to All That. And he, as he points out in the great collection of quotations, what is it, Bartram's? What is the book of where you can find the quotations of? You used to be able to look and find the quotations of famous authors.
Yeah, now you look on Google. and if Google thinks you're famous, they'll put your quote there. Right.
Yes. Once upon a time, there was things printed in on paper. Anyway, he said the only quote. He's a celebrated poet, by the way. I want you to know this. He's one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. And he says the only quotation he's known for is the title of his book, Goodbye to All That, because when he mustered out, as we say in the service, he turned his back on the rationale for war and his disgust with what had occurred in the First World War to him and others. And he said, I'm out of here. Goodbye to all that. To finish with a story, his poor mother got a letter saying he's dead, got a letter from him saying I'm alive, got a telegram from the Army saying he's dead. By the way, how many people lost their lives because they were given wrong information and decided to kill themselves, right?
That happens too, of course.
That happens.
That happened in Romeo and Juliet, right?
Yeah, exactly. The misinformation. Yeah. And as you know, we have state powers now that look after us and tell us that they will inform us when we get misinformation. I'll bet they would have got the Graves story wrong, by the way. They would have thought he was dead. But further, here's how they found out he was alive. He was taken to a hospital eventually from the field hospital. He, by the way, he was going to die. He said he would have died. He's laying in a field hospital. It was the middle of summer in France, and it was very hot, and particularly under the canvas. And he said to the doctor, the surgeon, I got to get out. You got to get me out of here. This heat is going to kill me. I can tell you, I'm just not going to make it. And the doctor said, well, look, if we do that, it's going to be a bunch of people carrying you and handling of you. You got a hole in your lung, a bad one. And he said, so you're safer here. I'm just sorry to tell you, but you're safer here. He says, I don't agree. I want out of here. You get me out of here. Surgeon says, I'm sorry. She said, about 3 hours later, the surgeon comes back and he says, okay, you get your way. All your chums are being shot up, and they're bringing them in by the dozens now, and we need the space. So while I don't recommend it, you're out of here. So they took him out of the tent, took him to another hospital where he said he could lay still, and he knew he was going to make it. He said if he could just lay still. So his mother's sister had a Welsh soldier, a friend of her, his aunt. She had a friend whose son was in hospital recovering, and she had bought some fruit in a basket, and gone to see him to say that the mother cared about him and all that. And so she's walking down the hall and she sees the name Graves on a door. She didn't know very many people named Graves, so she opened the door, and of course, there's Robert Graves laying there. So his aunt is looking in at him, and she thought he had died. And so then she left the hospital and notified the family, hey, I just saw him. How about that for her?
That's a wonderful story.
So I'm saying the man earned his stripes.
Did he write it in that book there?
It's all in the book.
Yeah.
It's all in the book. But the reason I thought it was so important, called attention to the listeners of the Taylor Report, is that he's very helpful on the issue of how we get into wars and how dangerous. He used a word, and I haven't ever seen it used elsewhere. It should have become a good word. He said that when he, after the wound, but he went to Britain, went home, And he said he listened to people talk about the war, and he couldn't take it. And he said they all talk newspaper language, and newspaper language is baloney. It's false. And he said he tried to tell them that what they were talking about was not accurate. And he said, of course, he was at the front, he could talk to people who were living it. And that was sanity for him. He said, I have to get out of England. I have to go back to my friends. They're sane because they speak honestly to each other. And one of the points he makes, and we've raised this on the show before, and it's going on now with Ukraine, and it goes on all over the world, actually, is that media can't resist atrocity stories. And the atrocity story functions as an incitement. And people do bad things because they read that somebody else did a bad thing. And he said this was very troubling to him at the time. And he gives an example, and I'll read it to you. He said when he joined, he says, I discounted perhaps 20% of the atrocity details as wartime exaggeration. That was not, of course, sufficient. In other words, that was an underestimation. He had a trained mind. He was a very smart guy, very, very smart guy. Read his poems. By the way, he's considered one of the great anti-war poets. A friend of Siegfried Sassoon. You must know Siegfried Sassoon.
I certainly do.
And Wilfred Owen.
Very much so. Okay.
These soldiers, by the way, were his friends, Sassoon being the closest of them. So he says, recently, I saw the following contemporary newspaper cuttings put in a chronological sequence. So the first one is from Königliche Zeitung, and by the way, Phil knows a little bit of German. You can feel free to correct me. And it says, this is a German paper. When the fall of Antwerp became known, the church bells were rung. And then it points out that is at Cologne and elsewhere in Germany. So when they said, okay, we captured Antwerp, in Germany they rang church bells. I suppose in the British mind that's bad enough. Okay, I got it. So then, same story, same. The story is picked up by Le Matin, French paper. According to the Königliche Zeitung, the clergy of Antwerp were compelled to ring the church bells when the fortress was taken. They're saying according to Königliche Zeitung. Königliche Zeitung says that they rang the bells in Cologne to celebrate a German victory in World War I. So the French paper picks that story up and they say, the clergy of Antwerp were compelled to ring the church bells when the fortress was taken. Then further, and this is Robert Graves, a classic book, memoir of his life in war. And this is from Corriere della Sera, right?
Okay, which is the newspaper of record in Italy, then and now. Right?
Phil knows a little bit of Italian too. And I appreciate it. Here's what they write. According to what the Times has heard from Cologne via Paris, the unfortunate Belgian priests who refused to ring the church bells when Antwerp was taken have been sentenced to hard labor. So we're going, now this is still working from the one stupid remark or one report in the German paper. Then, here's from this is again now from Le Matin. He's got these in sequence. So we've had the Germans taking in Antwerp and the German, and in Cologne they rang church bells. Now we're at the point where it says, from Le Matin, according to information which has reached the Corriere della Sera, Cologne, from Cologne via London, it is confirmed that the barbaric conquerors of Antwerp punished the unfortunate Belgian priests for their heroic refusal to ring the church bells by hanging them as living clappers to the bells with their heads down. That's where they're going from the same story.
And of course, and each time the story gets picked up by one more, they add a little bit to it.
Yeah.
And they get further and further from the source, and more and more wild the story.
You know, by the way, that's kind of a terrible trick that journalists like to do. I'm not telling you that. I'm hearing this from so-and-so via London, via Paris. Of course, the priests that rang the bells in Germany were not hanging upside down and being used as human clappers. Anyway, Robert Gray's point is, look out. Don't, please. He says, try to think closer to the reality, what you know of humans and all that. Then he goes, later in the book, he's talking about real atrocities. And this is especially for, I'd say, to be noted for Canadians. He says, I'm going to get it right. I'll just read it boldly. The troops with the worst reputation for acts of violence against prisoners were the Canadians. This is World War I, Robert Gray's, terribly wounded, not once but twice, by the way, who was a very, basically, a decent human being, although, and I recommend again, goodbye to all that, Robert Gray, he describes things that he did, which were ugly. He tells about being an officer. Incidentally, Phil, he was at one point in charge of an entire battalion. A battalion. He's 21 years old. And the reason, of course, he rose so quickly and so fast to that position is the others were dead, killed. And so because he was in charge of a battalion, Robert Graves, poet, author of I, Claudius, he had to attend a court-martial of an Irish Catholic member of the army who had thrown aside his weapon in a retreat. Instead of holding on to his weapon, he was in a state of shock, I guarantee you, as his shells were falling and he was running. He threw his gun aside. That's very serious. When I joined the Marine Corps and they gave me my M1, they said, this, which I'm giving you this, don't you ever let that go. That you and your M1 are not to be separated. When you have it, that's it. Nobody gets it except under orders from your officers. So when you throw a gun aside, you're quitting. See, you're finished with your military. At least that's what you have done by casting aside your weapon. So this Irishman, by the way, I mentioned he's Irish because Graves is very interested in everybody's nationality. And he notes people's behavior. And he always says who they are. Not nice, but again, that's... So I'm describing this guy who you have to say, because he's honest and he's sharing with you, you can learn something from him. So anyway, he's called to a court-martial. Now he says that what that soldier had done means death. You're going to be executed for that. But somebody has to say, do it legal. So the officers have to sit down and have described to them what happened. And then they make the decision. And then they shoot the guy. So he said he went to the court-martial. He was told to go. And he thought about it. And he said, I cannot do this. I can't do it. Because he says, if I don't say convict, if I don't, he said, they'll probably court-martial me. Not that it would be a death sentence, but it would be the end of him in terms of honorable discharge. He probably might make honorable, but he would certainly just be mustered out. And it mattered to him. But, so anyway, what he did was he found an officer. you have to find somebody with more rank than you have. So he found the guy. Only there was only one, he said, in the entire region, area, and he found him, and he said, you're more qualified than me. I have a problem with this. And the guy said, oh, sure. So he went and voted to execute, and they executed him.
That's an awful story.
That is an awful story. He also told the following story, and both Phil and I are part German, so this is and British.
So it appears Graves was too. I just looked him up on Wikipedia.
Oh yes, he's von Ranc.
He's von Ranc.
And do you know Ranc Studios, R-A-N-K yeah, Studios? Yeah. That's his cousin.
That's his cousin. Okay. And his father was kind of an Irishman.
Yes. Yeah. No. He's an Anglo-Irish.
An Anglo-Irish.
Yes.
Well, that's an Irishman.
Yeah, of sorts.
Brenda Behan said there's no such thing as an Anglo-Irishman. It's just a Protestant with property.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yes. So that's a fact. So, and he made his career in England, and as did Robert. And although, by the way, Robert Graves is very partial to the Welsh, and he explains why the Royal Welsh Fusiliers is spelled with a C, Welsh Fusiliers. It goes all the way back practically to Cromwell, I think, but they spelled it with a C, and so they didn't put an S in. And so even when it became officially the Welsh, not for them. And military institutions are like that. They have their own history, and they will they'll fight you to the death sometimes over their own history, their battalion, their division. My father was 3rd Division, very big on being, he was in the 3rd. He wasn't with those lousy guys in the 2nd. And he sure wasn't, though. But we had a term for them, swab jockey, that is, sailor. You know, there's all these distinctions, which it permits you to, when on leave, kill each other. When you're not killing the enemy, you go to a bar and kill each other. Ah, bingo. I would have sworn, I heard an angel say we're almost halfway, but we're making it there. So further on this matter of, here's a great individual, Robert Graves, poet, and he tells stories which, I don't know if he even understands what they say, but he said that he's in the trenches, World War I trench, and they took some, every trench had snipers. That is where you keep an eye on the other guy's trench. And they were sometimes only 200 yards apart. Shorter than that some places. So a good marksman, if he had the time and had a good spot, he'd just wait and bang. You get one or two a day, kill someone. So he went to a key spot for sniping. He was assigned to it. And he said he got into his place with his rifle, and he saw a German taking a bath, and he said he was naked. And he thought, he said, I can't kill a naked man. He looked, but here's what he did. He stepped over to a sergeant nearby and said, I can't do this. Gave him the rifle, and the sergeant killed him.
Oh, man.
He said, all right. But he said, physically I wasn't able, I couldn't do it. And so his sergeant takes the rifle.
You know, I got to say, there's this historical figure, Pontius Pilate. That's kind of what he did.
Came a little close.
Yeah, I'm washing my hands. I'm not doing this. But you can do what you want with him. That's okay. I'm not doing it, but...
Yeah. I'll finish up on this Canadian angle because I think it's... Again, I'm talking about... He's telling us, and we got to be careful, about atrocities. He says they didn't like to read their British papers because they said it's so silly because they would be saying what the other guy was doing and they would say to each other, we're doing that. I mean, you're talking about, you know... killing prisoners? Robert Graves talks at length about killing prisoners and who did it and why they did it. So anyway, speaking of the Canadians, the troops were the worst reputation for acts of violence against prisoners were the Canadians, and later the Australians. There's a job for a psychosociologist explaining what is it about Australians and Canadians in a British army would make them go to the front for the worst stuff. Look into that. The Canadians' motives was said to be revenge for a Canadian found crucified with bayonets through his hands and feet in a German trench. This atrocity had never been substantiated, nor did we believe the story freely circulated that the Canadians crucified a German officer in revenge shortly afterwards. How far this reputation for atrocities was deserved and how far it could be ascribed to the overseas habit of bragging and leg-pulling, we could not decide. At all events, most overseas men and some British troops made atrocities against prisoners a boast, not a confession. They were proud of it. By the way, I was in the Marines. I would tell people that. I knew I had people boast to me of things they had done or seen done. And by the way, it's one of those things where I'm asking for a friend. I mean, in other words, they describe something and you say, was that you or with the guy that, you know. Later in the war, I heard two firsthand accounts. A Canadian Scot quotes, "They sent me back with three bloody prisoners, you see, and one started limping and groaning, so I had to keep on kicking the sod down the trench. He was an officer. It was getting dark, and I felt fed up, so I thought, I'll have a bit of a game. I had them covered with an officer's revolver and made them open their pockets without turning round. Then I dropped a Mills bomb in each with the pin out and ducked behind the traverse. Bang, bang, bang. No more bloody prisoners. No good Fritzes, but dead ones." This is told directly to Robert Grace by a Canadian. By the way, I hope they all take it up. If they don't think this happened, please, you know, I have to tell you, it's in the pages of a classic memoir by Robert Graves, introduced by a very famous author, Paul Fussell, who studies these things. It's called an autobiography, but it's basically a memory of the war. So for good order, I'll give you we'll get the Australians involved. An Australian, speaking to Graves, well, the biggest lark I had was at Morlancourt, where we took it the first time. There were a lot of Jerrys in a cellar, and I said to them, "Come out, you camarades." So out they came, a dozen of them, with their hands up. "Turn out your pockets," I told them. They turned them out, watches and gold and stuff, all dinkum. Then I said, "Now back to your cellar. Back to your cellar, you sons of bitches," for I couldn't be bothered with them. When they were all safely down, I threw a half a dozen Mills bombs in after them. I got the stuff all right, and we weren't taking prisoners that day. So this is all by way of sobering folks up who, you know, read newspapers. And he says, look out when he, what was it, the term he used, is newspaper language. You know, the guy sitting there, the editor says, you know, we got to pump this up. We got to get everybody steamed. They're going to want to be giving, what is it, Biden's going to give $40 billion. I think I got the right.
$40 billion.
I was getting where billion doesn't sound like much. But
no,
anyway,
right.
$40 billion.
It is much. It's a lot of money.
It's money that he said he didn't have for the expansion of Medicare, or the establishment of a portion of Medicare in the U.S.
That's right.
And for the paying off the student loan problem.
Right.
He said he didn't have money for that.
Fixing the roads and bridges and highways of the United States?
Fixing
the passenger train system? No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we come to that part in the show where we ought to play the Old Phil Oaks to give us a taste so that that'll lead us into a discussion of unions.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. A young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
That was Phil Oakes. And, okay. And by the way, he had some great lines there, and he said the organized labor, they're complaining when they close the munitions plant.
Yeah?
We actually, I recall, somebody, I think his name was Jerry, what was his name?
Yeah, the guy from Jerryland, Jerry Diaz.
Jerry Diaz.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when they said, well, we don't think it's ethical to be providing military hardware to Saudi Arabia. By the way, wouldn't you think that was pretty much the test? Easy. That's a very low bar,
yeah.
And Jerry said, oh, hey, my members are making those things, you know, and that's very important. So anyway, that leads us to something important. I said last week on the show we spoke to Kim Sipes, and it spells it S-C-I-P-E. Don't say Skypes. He's Kim Sipes, and he had an article in Covert Action Magazine, and they went to the AFL-CIO convention. They were arguing that labor should have an independent foreign policy, something we've talked about on this show. Now, there's a new article by Richard Moser. You can find it in Counterpunch. June the 10th. It's got a great... the title isn't so great because I don't like people using question marks. If they know the answer to their own question, I'd just say, but anyhow, title is Moral Crusade or Class Interest. Does the U.S. working class have a material interest in Ukraine? You can find, by the way, Moser's own site, as I mentioned before, it's befreedom.co is what I got. It might be .com. And it's very pertinent because all he's pointing out is something, and this really goes broadly across society, maybe it has to do with your mother, Phil, the right of people to ask questions and say, what is this about? Why are we doing this? Is it in our interest? We don't get to be the governors and are not the governors of Ukraine. Ukraine is Ukraine's business. Russia's business. If they have a problem with each other, okay, we can ask questions. Our first responsibility is not to harm our own, right? And to try to keep the world a peaceful world. But we're living in an environment where you're not even supposed to say that. Are you noticing this, Phil?
I am noticing this. I noticed this morning that there was outrage generated by the Globe and Mail because a Canadian diplomat attended a reception at the Russian embassy. Well, if you have diplomatic relations with a country, they have receptions.
That's one of the things you do.
And you go to the reception. All of a sudden, this is unspeakable.
Yeah. Now, now they're searching for something to be upset by.
Yeah.
Also, we're told that you're not to read War and Peace. Apparently, in Ukraine has decided.
Yeah, it's bad.
And I got to be very careful about that. The government-led, the group that is in power in Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky and co., have made that decision.
Yes, it was his education minister.
Yes.
Yes.
They decided that you can't read. Another one, by the way, is a Taylor Report favorite, Bulgakov's novel, The
Master and
White
Guard. Yeah, the White Guard. Yeah,
no, The White Guard. Master and Margarita actually doesn't have anything. No, it's the White Guard.
The White Guard.
And Bulgakov captured the tail end of World War I as it was experienced in the city of Kyiv, 1918, where, if you can imagine, by the way, people caught up in wars, it's a nightmare. There had been the Tsar fell, replaced by Mr. Kautsky, replaced then by Mr. Lenin, and this family in Kyiv, they were loyal to the Tsar. They'd fought and supported the war. But now they find themselves in a matter of months, no Tsar. They hear there's going to be some type of social democratic republic. Then they hear that there's a Bolshevik government, but they're in Kyiv. They don't have any awareness of who. They're in the book, they're asking each other, who is this guy? Has anybody heard of him? The only one they knew the name of was Trotsky, he's from Ukraine. And because he'd been involved in the 1905 attempt to overthrow the Tsar, his name they knew. But beyond that, they had no idea who they were. Not that they had a plus or minus negative view of that individual, but just to show you how people, so the novel captures that, the nightmare. And the city still has German soldiers, but the German soldiers they lose the Kaiser. So then they are going to pack up and leave. And so they say, well, who's going to take over? Well, we hear that the Bolsheviks a long way off and not much of a threat. There's people called the White Russians who want to bring back the Tsar. And then there's a man named Petlura, and he's a nasty character from what they hear. And they don't know what army might be entering the city, and they have to decide as a family, their middle class or upper middle family, what they're going to do. And I really recommend it. Take the side of the people, read the book, because it's they're not people with power. They're people trying to cope, which is, you have to be very sympathetic to such people, because, somebody waves a banner and says, oh, we all believe in this banner, when they don't even know what that banner is. Petlura, you may know, was a terrible anti-Semite, and he represented the worst of form of nationalism in his area. He did capture Kyiv. There's many thousands were died, and many years later in Paris, he was assassinated by the relative of someone in Kyiv, who stopped him on the street and said, "Ah, Mr. Petlura." That's the end of that. Anyway, the novel's The White Guard. You cannot read it. That book is, the Minister of Education says don't read it.
Yes.
My guess is that amongst the educated people aware of these books, they probably have it on their shelf and read it anyway. But you also are not supposed to read War and Peace.
That's the that's quite shocking. I mean, this is one of the seminal works of Western canon, right?
Yes.
And throughout the entire Cold War, when they told us the worst things about Russians, nobody ever said to us, well, don't read Tolstoy.
Well, by the way, I mean, Tolstoy was with us.
Right. Yeah.
I know this is, now we're talking about, you know, it's like I Claudius. So you have to tell young people, break it to them, China and Russia were our allies, and we defeated Japanese fascism, and we defeated Nazi Germany, largely through the efforts of those two nations. The Chinese, they definitely took more casualties and distributed in return to defeat it. Today, people just blandly say to one another, oh, you know, they're bad, and Russians are bad. The Americans are particularly shameful in this respect because in the Crimea War, U.S. supported Russia. When Russia fought the British, the French, the Italians, whomever, the Turks.
Turks, yeah.
The United States government supported Russia, agreed with Russia. And, of course, we have Sarah Palin in Alaska about to become, she's going to be elected to Congress. Russia sold Alaska to the Americans for 25 cents and a visit to Florida or something. That was it. I mean, I would say that secured America's Pacific coast.
Yes, I mean, the Russians did a big favor for the Americans there.
By the way, the gesture was anti-British.
Yes.
The Russians knew what they were doing.
Yes, it was an anti-British initiative, and it was a successful one.
A successful one. And the other one, Phil, you and I talk about on the show periodically, is, of course, that when France and England were meeting with Confederate slaveocracy leaders and talking about how they could help them, in 1863, the Russian Navy arrived in harbor San Francisco Bay, to secure it. They said it was a friendly, hi, we're over here, we're just visiting. And New York, the two major harbors. And it was a notice to the British and the French that if they were to come in on the side of the slaveocracy, that the Russians would be there at the side of the Americans. So maybe the American right still resents the fact that they lost slaves because the Russians came in on the side of the Americans. Maybe this is their ultimate dislike, is based on all that fortune that went down the drain because the people were freed, recognized as humans.
Yes, and of course, as a classical music person, the best part of that story is that Lieutenant Rimsky-Korsakov, who was to become a great composer, was on board the Russian ship in New York Harbor, and he escorted Mrs. Lincoln to the theater. I just think it's the most wonderful story.
Yes. He was one of his proudest moments of his life. And they made big occasion. The president's wife came there to show them her appreciation of the government. No, we dredge up history to remind everybody that these things are all solvable. You're not talking to aliens or somebody. We go back. Now, to go to this article again and this is by Richard Moser, befreedom.com. Here's some of the things he says. Biden did not invent the fiction of the free world or the perennial struggle or of good versus evil. He simply recycled lines from the first Cold War long before him. John Kennedy, long twilight struggle, that was Kennedy's line, committed Americans to an anti-communist crusade that morphed into the unending struggle against any and all rivals after the fall of the Soviet Union. The problem, moral crusades tend to rule out the compromise in negotiations. Behind them lies the mirage of total victory. In Ukraine, this is a dangerous illusion for anyone that supports any side in the conflict. Even war at the scale of World War II that ended in as total a victory as could be imagined did not finish fascism, militarism, or empire. Those evils run deep because they sustain capitalism. And he brings up the call to war enjoys strong bipartisan support. Liberal politicians and their supporters have pushed pro-war attitudes deep into progressive territory by appealing to ideals of self-determination and agency, quote, agency. This also recalls the Cold War liberalism of the past when some radicals and many labor officials fell into line against the communist menace and supported the Vietnam War. And Phil, you know about that. You experienced all that. And he brings up, of course, and we talked to Sipes about this, Kim Sipes, but this article backs it up, that the AFL-CIO simply takes its orders, basically, from the State Department. They echo whatever they're told. And he cites this is now being challenged. There are people are starting to challenge, and he mentions particularly the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO. And this is really a highly pertinent point, in my opinion, because if you go to that, there's an interview with the Vermont AFL-CIO, and incidentally, it's not surprising, that's where Bernie Sanders is from. There's something going on. What is it about Vermont? I don't know.
They know their history.
Yeah, they know their
history. They know their history. So they're
the Green State.
They're not
the Green Mountain Boys.
They cannot be as crazed as the rest of the American people. They kind of got inoculated in their early history.
Yeah, you're right. They almost didn't join the
very close.
Very close to not joining.
Yeah,
they wanted to be the Vermont. I don't know who could blame them. But anyhow, if you read this article, and you can find it at the Challenge, the June 10th. Also, of course, quote, and it's Richard Moser, befreedom.com. You can click on this, the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, and what he says is that we need a general strike. He says, these guys are taking everything from us. The prices are going up. Wages are not. And certainly can't keep up with cost of houses, cost of education, everything. And he said to sober them up, to get what labor needs, labor has to independently exercise its own power. He says you can't stand with your hat in hand waiting for a Democrat to do you a favor. It's not going to happen. You actually have to take the steps yourself. And, of course, you mentioned Eugene Debs, people like that who are capable of organizing. But how about this? We're hearing from, who would have thought, a prominent AFL-CIO member calling for general strike. And he called for something else, which is very important. He says, and this would be dear to the hearts of Unifor members who are struggling at the moment to establish what kind of union they're going to be after the debacle of the fall of Jerry Diaz. There are advocates here of there being one person, one vote. As you know, the United Auto Workers, the old brother, sister of Unifor, they got so bad and things got so dark in terms of corruption that they eventually had enough rank-and-file activity that they decided that one of the solutions is to have one person, one vote. You don't get to be the head by a bunch of committees, a bunch of slate people who are insiders determining it. So he is calling for the head of the Vermont unions. He's calling for that for the AFL-CIO. And frankly, I'd say, well, hey, CLC, what did you take this up? Because they're sound asleep. And he's saying, and many trade unionists now in the States are saying, we ought to have an independent foreign policy. We have to protect our members. We have to understand their needs, which are totally ignored when these when the warmongers are on the loose. They decide whether we're going to go to war. They decide whether this, you know, they're going to allow you even to have a union. Incidentally, in Ukraine today, Mr. Zelensky's government, they've been, during this crisis, they've been passing legislation that hurts trade unionists in Ukraine. Strangely enough, the LCLCIO in the States, CLC in Canada, they don't say anything about that. So you'd say, why don't they have class consciousness? Clearly, the union members of Ukraine don't like this policy. So why would the CLC support it? You know, we need to speak up for organized labor in Ukraine, but that's a side issue. But start by saying we can't allow parties, including the NDP, to say, oh, yeah, we want a big war budget. Why should we be in favor of a big war budget? We have to say, in whose interest? What was this about? And also the first thing being that we're better off maintaining peace and also having a free trade and circumstances which benefit workers everywhere. That's what should be. And when we don't get that, these trade union bodies ought to be speaking up. And the worst aspect of it, I'm afraid, for Canada, and we just make this the closing point, is that we're actually NATO-ized in every aspect of our lives, every aspect. Somebody says, oh, what do you think of Myanmar? Well, I have to find out what, you know, NATO thinks, you know. NATO, I don't know. That's not my department. That's NATO's department. The last thing I'd say, for example, I'm going to keep coming back to this on the program. Canada actually doesn't have an army. NATO has a Canadian army. They can do with it what they want. It has to buy NATO weapons. It has to supply personnel. It has to attend meetings. It has to take its direction from NATO. And that's all you're saying is that you're colonized. You're a vassal. If you're in NATO, I'm sorry to break it to you, but you're a vassal. And your chief is our common president, Joe Biden, or Donald Trump, take your choice, and maybe Palin down the road. But, you know, no, look, if you're not maintaining your own sovereignty, then your little army is only there to serve that gang called NATO. So this is the Taylor Report. It's been a lot of fun. Thank Phil, and thanks Shay. We'll see you next week.